Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum. There's three lines open, 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. And this hour, we have Mark Brumley with us to answer your questions. Mark, of course, is the president of the most important publishing house in the Alpha Quadrant. Mark Brumley, welcome.
Great to be with you.
I should probably name the publishing house Ignatius Press.
Yeah, what is
like
that?
People
what
are probably like, oh, I don't know. I don't know who made the list this year of most important publishing houses in the Alpha Quadrant. Ignatius Press, find them at Ignatius.com. And sometimes when Mark comes, he has a book in mind that he's going to tell us about that he likes. Yeah. Did you have one in mind today, or are you just going to pull something
well,
out of your hat?
I do, actually, but I won't spend a lot of time on it because we didn't publish it.
Oh, really? You're going to tell me about a book you didn't publish?
Yeah.
Wow, you have not done that before.
I'm reading this book. Have you seen this book?
Yeah, oh, Jesus. The Eucharist is really Jesus?
Yeah, that's right. The Eucharist is really Jesus. Joe Heschmeyer.
Joe Heschmeyer. He's good, isn't he? That Joe Heschmeyer?
Yeah. It is published by, what's the publishing company?
Catholic Answers Press. The most important publishing house in the Beta Quadrant.
In the half of the Beta Quadrant, anyway. where the Klingons aren't doing bad things. But anyway, I've just been reading through this because, we distribute some Catholic Answers books. We don't have room for all of them. The guy's doing so many great things.
But sometimes you pick out a really good one and it'll make it on your list, right?
That's right. Yeah. I don't know. Have you published any books with Catholic Answers Press?
Yes, I have. And it is in your catalog there.
Oh, I see. This is where we were going.
Yes, right.
All right. Well, so anyway, I read through them, because I have to make sure there's no heresy. And I was just reading through this, which we're going to pick up and distribute in our catalog. The Eucharist is really Jesus. Timely, because of the Eucharistic revival, but the topic of the Eucharist is always timely.
Right.
So anyway, I wanted to mention that. But that's all prelude, not all, but it's partly prelude to Robert Spitzer. Did we talk about this book yet?
I've talked about it on the air with several people. I have it on my desk.
Have you read it?
I've read in it. That's what I like to say. I've
read. So the book is Science at the Doorstep to God, Science and Reason in Support of God, the Soul, and Life After Death.
Right.
And, when I read this as a manuscript, I thought, oh, wow, gee, this is pretty good stuff. Of course, Spitzer stuff is always good, but it was like, wait a minute, this is only 300 pages.
Is this the first chapter?
Did he leave something out?
Yeah, right.
This is pretty good stuff, but did he leave something out? Is he going to be able to cover all this stuff in 300 pages? But he does, remarkably, because we joke about Father Spitzer's books. They're often
long.
Very sizable.
Yeah.
But they're always substantive and engaging and all that. And he's really done a great job of doing a great apologetic for God, the soul, and the afterlife, which is, some of the foundational elements in apologetics, using not just science, he uses philosophy, but he shows how there are things in science, and you don't have to be a PhD in physics or something to benefit from this book. It's written more so than some writings on this topic that you see out there for kind of a popular, what I call the middle brow audience, to basically say, we don't need to be afraid of science. A lot of times, some Christians, some Catholics downplay science either because they think it's too hard, or they're kind of afraid that maybe science says something that they're going to have to grapple with from their faith perspective. But, Father Spitzer shows how there's a good confluence of science and science and philosophy on one hand and faith and theology on the other. So
give us the title one more time. You can get it at Ignatius.com. You can find it or wherever you get good Catholic books.
And Science at the Doorstep to God. I think you guys have it in your catalog too, I think.
Yeah.
So
I think
Ignatius.com.
Yep. And that's why you had to take Joe Heschmeyer's in your catalog, I think. Right?
That's right. No. We don't do that. We're not that way.
No.
But also encourage people to go out there, their local Christian bookstore, or local Catholic bookstore.
Yes, please do. Yeah. Buy all of the books that we just mentioned at your local Catholic bookstore. The number here, if you want to talk with Mark Brumley, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Mark Brumley is, as I said, the president of the most important publishing house in the Alpha Quadrant, but also just an extremely important person. And he won't tell you this, but he's an extremely important. He had to rush here from a board meeting for a Catholic university, and
it was great.
Yeah.
And University of St. Thomas, yeah. Houston, rah-rah.
And you were what, protesting the board? Or what were you?
No, I was.
Oh, you're on the board.
I'm a board member.
Oh, and congratulations.
We were learning about all the great things that the University of St. Thomas in Houston is doing to spread the Catholic faith and to form the next generation of Catholic leaders. So,
my complaint about the University of St. Thomas, I got to tell you, is that it's called the University of St. Thomas. There's a lot of universities named after St. Thomas, and I get very confused about which one is which.
Well, ours is the best.
Well, that clears it up for me then. Okay, now, well, now I know. The one in Houston is the best one. So that's just what I'll ask people. I would say, where'd you go? I went to Thomas Aquinas and whatever it is.
Well, Thomas Aquinas College is a college. This is a university. And, you know, it does, TAC does a lot of good stuff as a college. It has its particular approach. This is a university. Got a lot of other things going on. So not real competition there. There's some overlap, but they're
different
colleagues.
Right. Just once, somebody needs to name a university after St. Francis. We need a St. Francis university.
Franciscan University of Steubenville, right?
That's who they named that after?
Yeah. Oh,
I had no idea. All these, you know, that we got all these Franciscan University grads. Now they're all looking at me with angry faces on the other side of the glass. They are the grumpiest people. All right, let's go to Massachusetts.
Yes, let's do that.
Johnny's in Massachusetts watching on YouTube. And we're glad you waited, Johnny. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi. Thanks for accepting my phone call. As Christmas is approaching, what's the best answer to give to Protestants who say Christmas is pagan? Like short and simple answer.
It isn't. That's the short and simple answer.
Well, it has the name of Christ right in it. How many pagan things have you
Christ
seen?
Christ Mass. Now, they may, some Protestants. So let's be clear. The vast majority of Protestants don't think Christmas is pagan. So you got this kind of subgroup of kind of hyper-fundamentalistic people that are in that group, that Protestant group. But most Protestants, solid Bible-believing Protestants, do not regard Christmas as pagan. So one thing you might say is, well, you know, you think it's pagan, but the Catholics, the Orthodox, and the vast majority of Protestants, including Luther and Calvin, did not think that Christmas was pagan. All right. Take the word apart, Christ Mass. And while you might think the Mass is not especially your way of understanding Holy Communion or Eucharist, it's nevertheless centered on what Jesus did at the Last Supper. That's what the Mass is all about. And it's Christ Mass, so it's a Mass that celebrates the birth of Christ. So what's pagan about that? That's what I'd say.
Johnny?
Yeah. Some people, well, they bring up about the date, December 25, or sun worship, and, you know, the stuff like that. Particularly the Jehovah's Witnesses come up with stuff like that. You know, historical, I don't know, situations where, I don't know, we got these ideas from sun worship and what other things they threw at me.
Sometimes the Christmas tree gets thrown in there. Oh, yeah, there we go, the Christmas tree, yeah.
Yeah, the Christmas tree is just a decorated tree. By the way, next time a Jehovah's Witness raises this objection, ask him what he calls, what's the name of the first day of the week?
Oh, okay. Monday.
Sunday. Yeah. No, it's not Monday. Well, although you could use Monday. First day of the week is Sunday. Oh. Second day of the week is Monday. Sunday is day of the sun. Monday is day of the moon. He doesn't, you know, not use the calendar because these names had a pagan origin. So not everything that pagans do was wrong. You know, pagans prayed. So are Jehovah's Witnesses going to give up praying because pagans prayed too? It's not that praying's a problem. It's who you pray to. So that's one point. Second point, with respect to the idea that somehow Christmas was about sun worship, that's just false. There's no historically reliable evidence that Christmas was about sun worship. Sometimes there's this theory that Christians started celebrating the birth of Jesus to counter the Roman Sol Invictus holiday. It's you know, some of the historical scholarship today is saying it's actually the reverse, that the pagan holiday was put in competition with what Christians were doing. But that's kind of irrelevant either way. Christians can honor the birth of the Savior. There's nothing pagan about that. And the earliest traditions had this happening, Jesus' birth sometime in December, around that time of year. The fact that it happens to coincide with when the days of the year start to diminish. Is that right?
Yeah, no.
They're diminishing. No, they're expanding. They're growing.
They've finished diminishing.
Right.
Yeah, the darkness
they've
is
finished
ending.
Diminishing. That's right. Get my seasons right. When the days of the year start expanding points to the fact that Jesus is the light that's come into the world. God arranged the universe that way. What's wrong with celebrating the birth of his son, who is the light of the world, around the day that begins to commemorate the expansion of the light in our experience, our little segment of the cosmos called planet Earth? So I'm putting all these things out. I know from ample experience that some Jehovah's Witnesses, probably most, won't accept what you're saying. But what you're going to do is you're going to plant the seed of good doubt in their minds. And you know, there's such a thing as good doubt. When you believe nonsensical things, it's a good thing when you start to doubt them. And the idea that Christmas is pagan, shouldn't be celebrated, is a nonsensical thing. So let's plant the seed of good doubt.
Johnny, thanks very much for the question. It also gives me the opportunity to point you to a couple episodes of Catholic Answers Focus that I would like to point you to. Next week, as a matter of fact, our next week episode of Catholic Answers Focus is with Trent Horn. Yeah. And it's about the question of the episode is, was the virgin birth copied from pagan mythology?
Right.
And of course, Trent, as his usual, funny and erudite self in that episode. We also have an old episode that you can find on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's called A Very Pagan Christmas with Jimmy Akin. And it's all about this, it's this idea that Christmas came from paganism. So if you want extended conversations on the virgin birth and Christmas itself as having pagan origins, check them out, because those arguments are wildly exaggerated, as was the death of Mark Twain. And that brings us to the break. We'll be right back with more. Mark Brumley, Open Forum, 888-318-7884.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
At EWTN, we're committed to spreading the gospel from a Catholic perspective, touching millions via television, radio, publishing, and the internet. Right now, EWTN is looking for qualified people to fill a number of exciting positions. Make a difference using your God-given talent. Visit EWTN.com/employment today. EWTN is the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Mark Brumley is our guest. It's open forum. You are welcome to call 888-318-7884. At the moment, just two lines open, but you can get one of them, 888-318-7884. I have to read the ad now. Carrie has been writing the ads lately. I don't know if he's trying to make me look ridiculous or I don't know what it is, but Mark, I'm going to read the ad now, and you try to see which sentences Carrie put in here to make me look ridiculous. All right?
I'm listening.
Still looking for that perfect Christmas gift for your loved ones? Look no further. Shop.catholic.com's store-wide sale is just the right item for everyone on your list. Hundreds of items at 10 to 25% off and more. If you miss this sale, you'll be madder than a wet hen. Is anything standing out to you yet? Shop.catholic.com. Besides our outstanding selection of Catholic books by your favorite authors, we've got coffee, rosaries, scapulars, puzzles, candles, clothing, and so much more. If you miss it, your friends may say, "That boy ain't got the sense God gave a goose." shop.catholic.com.
I don't see anything in that that would be trying to trip you up.
Nothing seems humiliating in that?
No, not at all.
All right.
Kind of down home. By the way, I did not know it was a site-wide sale. I was just over there checking some things out, and I didn't catch that point. So thank you for mentioning that, because
over at shop.catholic.com. Okay, good.
Yeah. I'm going to go there tonight.
Get all your rosaries and coffee and scapulars and puzzles and more.
Indulgences? Do you have indulgences available?
We are not selling indulgences, no. We got out of that business. When did we get out of that? We were told to get out of it, I believe it was in 1517. We were
Something told, like that. Yeah, well, a little bit later after that, probably.
A little bit later.
More like Council Trent.
They finally made it clear, get out of the selling indulgences business. We're joking, by the way. We never sold indulgences.
No, that's not historically accurate.
That's not historically accurate, and we can't even give you indulgences. We're the wrong people to see for that. Ask your pastor about that. Jason's in New Jersey watching on YouTube. Jason, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi, guys. Thank you for taking my call. And sorry, I just want to say you're underselling it a bit. You're actually popular in the all the way to the Omega Quadrant truth. So you're really popular.
The Omega Quadrant. Yeah. Holy smokes, I am popular. I'm going to bring that up in my salary negotiations. That this call is going to get mentioned.
You really should. Tell them I sent you.
Thank you, Jason.
Yeah. So my question is regarding a quote that I recently heard. It was from Saint Maria Faustina, and I've only read a little bit on her, but she seems really great. And I questioned something, and the quote was, "If the angels were capable of envy, they would envy us for two things. One is receiving Holy Communion, and the other is suffering." So, as far as I understand, the reason for that is because we get to participate, you know, in the Lord's grace, and you know, the communion, you know, his divine essence, and then suffering his human nature. So, like, in unique ways that angels do not. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah.
But the thing first I want to know, is that accurate to what you two might think that means? And the second part is, I assume that angels could sin because, you know, there's a pretty famous event, beginning of time, you know, when that caused us to fall.
Yeah.
So I assume that sin was very possible for them, as well as suffering, because what else would hell be for if not for suffering? And, you know, demons being fallen angels would be there as well. So I just, this quote makes sense to me and doesn't at the same time. So
got it.
I was just wondering, what are the thoughts, what are your thoughts there on
Mark?
Those two parts?
Well, that happens to you too, where you come across something that both makes sense and doesn't at the same time. Happens to me all the time. So I wanna ask Cy what he thinks that Saint Faustina is getting at when she says, "If they could envy, they would envy the Eucharist and suffering." You know, obviously there's a hypothetical there which assumes that they can't envy. Get that, they'll touch on the question of sin in a moment. But what do you think she's getting at when she talks about that? Because that seems like a pretty out there thing to say.
Yeah, I think both of these have to do with if the angels could envy us. They're both related to our body, which the angels don't have. And so my guess would be she's saying that the greatest goods that we can do with our bodies are to receive Christ in the Eucharist, and that is such an intimate communion with the man Jesus, who is himself God, that the angels marvel at the intimacy of him giving himself to us in that way. And the suffering one, I assume, is related to meritorious suffering, because there could be suffering that doesn't merit anything, but in our suffering, united with the suffering of Christ, we can merit graces for ourselves and for others that makes our suffering an even greater thing than physical pleasure, for example. That they would envy our ability to merit in that way with Christ.
Yeah, I think that's it. The idea behind the use of the envy there is when we envy someone, well, we can get into a subtle discussion about the full nature of envy and being covetous and all of that. But at its core, there's a perception of some good thing that I lack, that I want. Now, in a sinful form of envy, there's also a kind of sadness at the enjoyment of that good thing that somebody else has. But what's at its core is there's a perception of a good thing, and I lack that good thing. And so what I think St. Faustina is saying is that the angels, if they could envy, they would be envious because they would perceive the wonder and the beauty and the sublime goodness of the Eucharist and the value of that kind of self-giving love that takes on the form of suffering. You know, normally we say suffering is a bad thing, but yet self-giving love can freely choose to suffer for the love of the beloved. And so in the Eucharist, which is certainly a sign of not only Jesus' resurrection, but obviously his crucifixion that brought about the condition of the resurrection, where the resurrection had to happen. And so the angels they do appreciate the tremendous divine love that's expressed in the Eucharist and in suffering, the meritorious suffering that you described. And so I think that's what she's trying to say, that they can't envy, but if they could, they would perceive it. It's almost as if they would envy because the sublime goodness of these things, the Holy Eucharist and this participation through merciful love and suffering. So I think that's what she's getting at there. Then the second thing is, well, wait a minute, Brumley. Wait a minute, Kellett. Wait a minute, Brumley. What are you guys talking about? Angels can sin, and therefore they should be able to envy. And in fact, you could push the point further that one interpretation of the fall of Satan is precisely that he envied. He envied the divine love that was going to be showered on man, and therefore that's what brought about the fall. Now, it's bound up with an understanding of pride and all these other kinds of things. And that's correct. It's true to say that angels in this primordial state at the very beginning of things were given a freedom to define who they were, for or against God. And Satan and the angels that were allied with him chose to reject God, and therefore they set themselves eternally against God. And the unfallen angels, the ones that chose God, are aligned with God and for God and in communion with God. So now we say because the nature of angels and the nature of their choice is such that they were given the power to make a permanent choice. And with respect to the angels that are in heaven, that are in God's presence, they're so filled with the divine presence that there's nothing that they could see or experience that can rival God, that they might choose over God. When we sin by taking an apparent good and valuing it over something that's really good. And in the case of sin, the really good thing is God. God or God's will expressed in some way. So when we sin, we choose this apparent good. We treat it as if it were even better than God. Well, in heaven, the angels and the blessed in heaven, there's nothing that can rival God, that we see God in his fullness. And so there's nothing that could be a possible alternative choice to God. He's so overwhelming in his beauty and his goodness and his love. On the other hand, fallen angels have chosen to value themselves at their core at odds with God. And so when they see God, they see him as a rival for that love. So they see him as a horrible thing, as something that would sort of rip themselves from themselves. And they so don't want that they can't even get to the place where they could experience God face to face. Even in the shadow of his glory is so repugnant to them that they won't let go of themselves and their self-regard even for an instance to delight in God. So that's the great mystery of the fall of the angels. But your, I think your instinct is right, Jason, when you say that, yes, angels can indeed suffer and they can indeed sin, and that's the fall of the angels. But after the test, the angels have the test involves their final choices, as it were. And so for the unfallen angels, they're not in a position to sin. They're in a position to experience heavenly beatitude. And for the fallen angels, they're not in a, they are suffering, and the suffering is their self-willed disregard for the divine love.
That you can hear the music, Jason. That means we've got to take this break. Thank you very much for the question. I hope the answer was helpful to you. And I'd say keep reading Sister Faustina. She is awful good. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Finish the sentence.
My family needs to...
That's tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Mark Brumley is our guest, and it is Open Forum, 888-318-7884 is the number. And I rarely do this, but I'm going to ask a question of Mark because that's my privilege as the host. I'm allowed to ask him a question. It's a quiz question, Mark.
Okay.
Mark, what feast is celebrated by the Catholic Church tomorrow?
Let's see. The feast of, let me just put this out there. Could be wrong. The Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Oh, that's amazing. Is that just a guess? That was just a guess?
Yeah, just random.
Just randomly guess.
Every year around December 7th, people ask me that question.
Oh, and then
And I give an answer, and it's so far it's worked every time.
The Feast of the Immaculate Conception is a holy day.
It is.
Sometimes referred to as a holy day of obligation because it comes with an obligation. So right. What am I supposed to do tomorrow, Mark? What's my obligation?
You are supposed to go to Holy Mass.
Okay.
That's what you're supposed to do.
I can do that. I'll do that. I'll go to Holy Mass.
It's to celebrate the Immaculate Conception of Blessed Virgin Mary. Doesn't have to do with the virginal conception of Jesus. Sometimes people get those things confused. The Immaculate Conception has to do with the conception of Mary in the womb of her mother. The virginal conception of Jesus has to do with the virginal conception of Jesus in the womb of his mother, Mary, the Immaculate Conception took place, as far as we know, in the normal way in which marital intercourse and conception takes place, except Our Lady was preserved from original sin from the very, very first moment of her conception, which means she had the grace of God from the most first moment of her conception. And of course, in the case of Jesus, he was the Son of God, and so he was conceived immaculately in that sense, filled with the Holy Spirit, but he was conceived without a human father. So that's the difference between those two. And tomorrow we celebrate this wonderful beginning of the new redemption, of the new covenant that Christ is going to win on the cross. This is amazing. The amazing thing is that Christ's redemptive work that he's going to win on the cross, the grace of redemption, he applies to his mother, to his own mother, before his own conception. That's just a wonderful mystery, and it's just a very much a God thing.
You know, this is how I think he can do it. He's God.
Yeah, he's God. Well, so, that's right. And he transcends time. He makes all of us. We all, the great mystery of God interacting with human freedom is we all exist because human beings chose to abuse freedom at the beginning of the human race. But God wasn't caught off guard. He knew that was going to happen. And he willed you and me to be here through the abuse of freedom that is sin. And that's a great mystery.
It is a great
mystery. We can't fully understand that. But if Adam and Eve hadn't sinned, you wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here.
Felix culpa.
Yeah.
That's a lot to process. I can't process it. Yeah. It's, as you said, it's a mystery. The number here is 888-318-7884. One more question about the Immaculate Conception of Mary.
Sure.
How do we know that she was conceived on December 8th?
Well, we celebrate the birth of Our Lady in early September, you know, so you can do the math and calculate, go back from September 9 months before that, and you get to the prior December. So.
Oh, all right.
There you go.
All right. I see. I actually didn't know that. I didn't know how you were going to answer that. That didn't occur to me, but
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a whole nother question of why September 8th, but that's for another conversation.
In other words, move on is what you're saying. Antonio is in Houston, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Antonio, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Good evening, guys.
Good evening.
Good evening. My question is about the in the Bible that says whatever is loose on earth is loose on heaven, and what is bound on earth is bound on heaven. Can you cite some examples that are loose on earth and what are bound on earth? Something like that.
The authority to bind and loose. So Matthew 16:18-19, Jesus tells this to Peter, that he gives Peter the authority. He also gives the authority to bind and loose to all the apostles in Matthew 18:18. And let's get some context here. This is a phrase. It's part of the rabbinic or the traditional rabbis of that time, Jewish authorities of that time. And some of this language goes back to Isaiah chapter 22, which speaks of the master of the palace having the authority to open and shut the doors to the house of David. So the idea there, David being the king of Israel and the master of the palace, having the ability to admit or keep out people. And so what Jesus is saying essentially here, boiling it down and oversimplifying to Peter in this Matthew 16, is that Peter's sort of functioning as the prime minister of the kingdom of heaven. And so he has authority to declare things in keeping with the covenant and God's moral law, or at odds with the covenant, God's moral law, and the authority to admit people back into the community who are repentant, to push people out of the community if they're unrepentant. And what Jesus gives to Peter as a single apostle, chief of the apostles in Matthew 16, he gives to all apostles in Matthew 18. So that's the context. Now, what's an example of binding and loosing? Well, I think you see an example of binding and loosing in Acts chapter 15, when the question arose of whether or not Gentile Christians needed to be circumcised in order to belong to the community of the church. The Jewish believers, of course, were all circumcised. That was part of the Mosaic. Well, it precedes the Mosaic covenant, but it's part of that. And so the assumption that lots of early Christians had is that you want to be part of the community of the Messiah, which is the Messiah is the Messiah of Israel. Then you need to be part of the community of Israel. And the way you become part of the community of Israel, part of the covenant people, is to be circumcised. Well, you look at the first half of the book of Acts, and you see that all that God does there to reveal his will to Peter and the other apostles, it becomes that they start to discern that this is not something that is required or part of or beneficial to the new covenant of Jesus Christ. And so they come to a decision in Acts chapter 15 that Gentile Christians don't have to be circumcised. And in fact, they describe that decision that they make when they write a letter and explaining themselves. They describe, they say, it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us. So they identify their authority to, as it were, loose people from the obligation of circumcision as not simply their own decision, but the decision of the Holy Spirit. So that's where we see in Acts chapter 15 an example of something that was loosed in heaven being reflected in a judgment on the part of church leadership on earth. In that case, it wasn't simply Peter, but Peter and the other apostles in Acts chapter 15.
Okay, Antonio?
Can I ask a partial? Women being allowed to be priests, is that part of the loose and, you know, loose on earth or bound on earth, something like that?
Well, that's a question that's more akin to whether or not, let's say, the Pope or all of the bishops of the world could get together and decide that we're no longer going to have a commandment against stealing, right? So, we're going to abolish the seventh commandment because the church has the authority to bind and to loose. So we're going to loose all the disciples of Jesus from the obligation not to steal other people's property. Well, the answer to that is no, they don't have that kind of authority. Remember that it really, if we wanted to translate this passage from Matthew 16 properly, it would say, whatever you bind on earth, having been bound in heaven, will be bound on earth. You know, so the priority is what's going on in heaven, what God has determined and what God has revealed, and that gets reflected in the authority on earth. So when it comes to things that are constitutive, they're part of the very constitution of what God has revealed, whether that has to do with doctrine or it has to do with practice or morality, if something is revealed by God or is necessary in order to uphold what is revealed by God, that's not something the church is free to bind and loose, because God himself, in the act of revealing it or in the act of ordering things in such a way that something that's taught has to be taught in order to uphold revelation, God himself in revealing it has in that sense bound the church. The church's role can be to declare whether something that's proposed is consistent with revelation. So when the church says only men can be ordained priests, the church is declaring what God himself has determined, or if you want to say what God himself has bound, we can use that language. So this authority to bind and loose is not the authority to do whatever somebody decides he wants to do. It's the authority that God has given to take what God has given to us and to declare it for the community, to apply it to the community.
Antonio, now I will leave that there because we have come up upon the break. We'll take that break. Thanks very much for the call and the questions. I hope that was helpful to you. We will be right back with more Open Forum with Mark Brumley right after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 2013. EWTN News Nightly launches from Washington, D.C., bringing news and analysis from a Catholic perspective to TV viewers and radio listeners worldwide.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Tomorrow we got kind of a fun show for you, so I want to tell you about it, and then we will get right back to the phones. Our first show ever from Italy. It's a pre-recorded first hour, but it's the flannel panel from Rome. And so it's the news of the day from a Catholic perspective with Chris Check and me and Joe Heschmeyer. But it's recorded from Rome, and I'm super excited about it because I want to do more of these shows in various places. And now we've got the recording technology to do it. Second hour will be Game Show with Carlo. And that's always fun. I'm pretty sure you're going to hear some Pig Latin. And also the game show is just a nice Friday activity. So join us tomorrow for two interesting hours of radio, I think. But this hour, we've got Mark Brumley with us, and you are welcome to call with your questions, 888-3187-884. Mark Brumley, of course, the president of Ignatius Press, and a very, very important Catholic.
I'm wondering when you guys were in Rome.
Oh, I wondered what all that hmming was. I thought Treebeard was on the show with us for a second there.
Well, he is, actually. And,
is he?
That wasn't him.
Well, welcome, Treebeard. It's going to be a very slow show now.
Very slow.
Wait, why are you wondering about when we were in Rome? We were in Rome in November. Did I not tell you that I was going?
What was going on in Rome in November?
Well, first of all, the synod was over, so everybody went home and we had the city to ourselves. And that's the time to go after a big synod. Then you get the place to yourself. And then we were on pilgrimage. We went with 35 pilgrims.
Oh, man, I'm going to have to go on pilgrimage with you guys sometime. That'd be fun.
It is fun. It's a lot of fun.
Of course, I have to say, there are a lot of great pilgrimages out there, but the best pilgrimages are Steve Ray's. Sorry.
What? This is not the time to say that. When I just said that we went on pilgrimage... That carries an insulting implication that ours was not as good as.
You got the best.
Like, say it at another time.
Really, really, really good. So you and Tim Gray are really, really good.
Oh, we're at the Tim Gray level, but we have we can't get up into the atmosphere where
Tim's going to call me up and say, Brumley, what are you saying?
No, I actually have to say, I never thought I would be on Tim Gray's level of anything. So I feel actually this whole thing turned around in a way that I'm perfectly comfortable and happy with. There we go. All right, Dan in Kansas listening on Sword of St. George Radio. Is there a better name for a Catholic radio station? Sword of St. George. It's not even St. George Radio. It's the Sword of St. George.
St. George.
That's a heck of a good name. Dan, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering about, I am a Catholic, but my mother-in-law is not, and I was wondering about a delicate way to either give her a book or explain to her why you need a priest to have the Eucharist. She believes when she takes communion, basically, that it'd be kind of like the same thing, and at least that's what she kind of explained to me one time, and I haven't wanted to stick my neck out and talk to her too much about it yet, but I didn't know if you have any tips or books.
Well, don't stick your neck out anywhere near the Sword of St. George. That's a bad plan. Mark, how do we explain that we need a priest for the Eucharist?
Well, because at the Last Supper, Jesus called together the 12 and the apostles. So these are men that he, you know, as he says there in Luke chapter, is it Luke 22? He says he's bestowing on them a kingdom, right? And he's having the apostles share in his kingly, priestly role. And so he says to them to do what he's doing, commemorating his sacrifice, and do this in memory of me. So Christ himself had his apostles take on this role of continuing to lead the celebration of the Eucharist. And then the apostles themselves called certain men and laid hands on them and gave them the same authority, same share in this special priestly ministry that Jesus shared with his apostles. So that's why the Eucharist is associated with a priest. Now, most Protestants believe in what's called the priesthood of all believers, and we Catholics would agree that there is a common priesthood that everybody who's a baptized follower of Jesus Christ possesses. But that doesn't mean, just as it did the fact that all of us were called to be special messengers of the gospel, and in that sense, apostolic, that didn't mean that there weren't a special dedicated group of men, the 12, who were the apostles, that everybody had the same equal ministry in the early church. Obviously, St. Paul tells us the apostles came first in terms of authority in the church. So the mere fact that we all have a kind of priestly sharing in Jesus's priestly ministry doesn't mean that there's not a ministerial priesthood. And so it's quite, not only would we say it's proper, but we'd say it's necessary, because it's Jesus himself who offers himself in the Eucharist. Jesus does that. Jesus says, this is my body, this is my blood. And so someone who is going to utter those words has to be someone who is set apart or consecrated in a special way to share in Jesus's priestly ministry, over and above the kind of set apartness or consecration we all have in baptism. So that priest, through that priest, that ministerial priest, Jesus makes himself present, representing himself to the community or to the congregation as his body and as his bride. And so that priest takes on that special role. And that's why it's appropriate and necessary that it be a ministerial priest that offers the Eucharistic sacrifice, just as it was Jesus himself who offered the Eucharistic sacrifice of himself at the Last Supper. So there's a continuation that the apostles had in that ministry of Jesus, and the apostles continue that on in the ministerial priesthood of bishops and priests today. So that's how Catholics see that role and why that's important.
Dan, if you'd like, just hang on the line. We have a little booklet called 20 Answers, the Eucharist. Oh, and if you'd like it, I would, just for, you know, it might be helpful to you, I will send it off to you. Just let Edgar know where you are.
There's this other thing.
I'll also send you Joe Heschmeyer's book, The Eucharist is Really Jesus. I don't know why I didn't think of that. Mark was already talking about how good that book is right at the beginning. So you get two Eucharist books. Dan, thanks very much for the call from Sword of St. George Radio, which I think is near Manhattan, Kansas.
Awesome.
And the best name for a radio station. Tim is in Ohio listening on 910 AM. Tim, you are very welcome here. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Tim.
Yeah, I apologize. I am on speakerphone. I'm talking on my car. So ever since Ohio has had legalized abortion and marijuana, is myself and a guy I work with from California have had a lot of debates on sin. And he has asked me some questions, and I'll tell you, I'm not the best Catholic in the world, you know, but I'm not the most knowledgeable. So he's asked me,
first was, how do we know that man goes to heaven? So I did find a verse in the Bible that showed that. But then he says, no, how do I know that man goes to heaven or hell for eternity? And his question is, why is Jesus coming back to judge the living and the dead if we've already know that we're in heaven or hell? And I cannot find a good answer for that for him.
Okay. You get it, Mark? You look puzzled, but you got...
So the question is, why is Jesus coming back when some of us, you know, will have died and gone on to our judgment? There'll still be some people, presumably,
why would we say he's coming back to judge the living and the dead if the dead have already been judged? Is that where you're coming from, Tim?
Ah, okay.
Yes. And I typed in the Catholic Answers, and the answer that I got, it wasn't good either.
Okay.
It was a little confusing.
Okay.
So there are two ways. Let
him answer, Tim, because we've got a short of time. Go ahead.
Okay, so there are two ways we can think about our judgment. We can think about simply what we've done in relation to our history and so on, and how we relate to God. So we call that the particular judgment, right? Me as a particular person, I'm being judged. And we can also think of our judgment, not just in terms of the things that I've done in my life, sins against God, sins against other people in my life, but the effects of my sin on all of on the future, beyond my life, and on other people. The effects of other people's choices beyond their lives on me and other people, and that how all of that fits together and is judged is what we call the general judgment, right? And so when the Bible talks about Jesus returning to judge the living and the dead, what that means is those who are alive when he comes will be judged. Those who are dead, who have already died, their judgment, whatever happened in their, what we call their particular judgment, will be seen, we can say anew, or if you want to say from a different point of view, from an additional point of view, that takes into consideration the whole sweep of history, not just their own individual lives and their own individual choices, but the whole sweep of history. So that's why we can speak of the judgment from those two different vantage points, and why we can speak of the judgment of the living, whoever's living at that time, and the judgment of those who've already died, not just for the particular sins of their lives, but on the totality of all of human sin and all of human history.
Now, Tim, thank you for letting him answer, but excuse me. Tim, do you have a follow-up for him, or did that do it?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be very difficult to try to explain to him.
Right. I would just say, because you know, all the things that have happened in history, they don't involve me directly at my own particular judgment, but they're going to be consequences that outlive me for the things that I've done. And ultimately, I'm going to have to be accountable for those things. They haven't happened yet. if we want to think about it in terms of time and eternity. So.
Okay.
I don't sound entirely satisfied, Tim, but I don't know. We've just got a few seconds left. Did you want to ask him one more follow-up, or are you?
Well, like I said, this guy is a very, very good debater. The Bible very.
Yeah.
So, you give him an answer and he comes back with something. But I have one other quick question that my priest says something that I don't understand. When he blesses the host, he says, with the angels and the dark angels. And I've asked people, did you hear that? And they don't know what that means either.
Are you sure he's not saying archangels? Angels and
archangels? Every time it says dark angels, maybe he is saying archangels. But
yeah, the prayer is archangels. So that's probably what he's saying.
If he's saying dark angels, I'd ask him again. And if he doesn't answer, I'd talk to the bishop about it. Because he's definitely not supposed to be saying that. But I think he's saying angels and archangels. Tim, great questions. I'm sorry that the answers you got at Catholic.com didn't seem adequate, but now we'll have this answer that Mark just gave over there at Catholic.com. So I appreciate you improving the website by asking your question. It improves all the time, thousands and thousands of answers there, and they're getting better all the time. Mark Brumley, thank you very much for coming on and doing the hour with us.
Thank you.
I don't think I will see you again before Christmas, so I'm going to say I hope you have a very Merry Christmas.
And I hope you do as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Tomorrow, flannel panel from Rome and then the game show. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.